Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zeb Larson, and we're here today with Guy Laron, talking about his book, Six-Day War, The Breaking of the Middle East, published by Yale University Press in 2017. Laron brings a new perspective to a well-studied topic, which is how the economic context and domestic politics of the Israeli and Arab states pushed them closer to war in 1967. Laron shows that similar trends were confronting each state, ranging from economic slowdowns and the weakening of developmental aid to weak civil-military relations, and these ultimately fed dangerously belligerent impulses. The broader context of the Cold War in turn pushed these powers into a conflict that continues to shape the Middle East today. Dr. Laron, welcome to the New Books Network. Tell us a little bit about yourself and where you went to school.
Well, I went to school in Israel. I did my first and second degree in history at Tel Aviv University, and then I went to do a PhD in international relations at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Sometimes people ask me why I switched from history to international relations, and I usually joke by answering I was young, I needed the money. Which is true. I mean, the international relations department at the Hebrew U, that they had scholarship at the time, and Tel Aviv University didn't. But either way, I was still a historian. I was just doing international history in an international relations department, which I work in today. And but it's very tolerant towards, you know, different kinds of methodologies looking at international relations as, you know, a field of knowledge rather than a discipline.
That's so interesting. It's good to know that scholars can find refuge occasionally in other departments.
Right.
And what was your dissertation about?
My dissertation was about Israeli-Egyptian relations between 1952 and 1956. I started with 1952 because that was the date of the Free Officers' Revolution in Egypt, and ended with the Suez Crisis at the end of 1956. The unsexy subtitle to the dissertation was The Influence of Domestic Politics on Foreign Policies. And, you know, the main argument was that Israel and Egypt got into war not because they had a conflict of interest that they could not solve, but rather as a result of their stormy domestic politics. And since you read my book, you can see that I'm still stuck arguing the very same questions.
Yeah, I feel like I can see at least the connecting line. But let's flesh that out for our listeners. So this book, The Six-Day War, how did this project come together? You have sort of a funny introduction to it at the very beginning.
Right. So, what I start with that is that I hate people that begin their book writing that they wrote this book by accident. I mean, how can you write a book by accident? It's, it sounds unreal. It takes a lot of time and energy. But I really wrote the Six-Day War book by accident because, you know, I was researching the war and thinking about the war without ever giving a full account to myself that I was doing that. So it starts with a book launch event that I participated in when it was the 40th anniversary to the Six-Day War in 2007. And it continued through various courses I taught and articles I wrote. And then there was, you know, both the opportunity. I had a time off. I had a sabbatical at Oxford. And also I suddenly realized that suddenly the 50th anniversary wasn't very far off. And if I'll hurry, I might be able to, you know, to publish the book on time. So it was like context and opportunity. And both of them pushed me in the same direction.
Okay. That's interesting how that comes together. What's the framework of this book? I think you explore a really complicated topic in a really interesting way.
I wrote a little bit about the Six-Day War before embarking on a full-fledged book about the Six-Day War itself. And I did it also because I thought that will make more sense for a publisher. And then I thought, wow, so many books were written about the Six-Day War. Can I say something new or original? And so I started to read around. I usually don't start by, you know, write different pieces of the project and see how they fit together. I need to, you know, read as much detail as I can. And then suddenly I can see the forest from the trees. And when I read about the combatant states, the states that were involved in the war, the more I read, the more they seem similar. You know, usually people don't compare Israel's economy and politics to those of its neighbors. Sometimes, you know, a lot of times they portrayed it as a case apart. But the more I read, I said, well, you know, there's a connecting thread there. The Israel, Syria, Egypt, they seem to be in a bad place in terms of their economies, and that mightily affected their politics. So and then it was like, aha, so that would be my contribution, that people wrote about or touched the matter of civil military relations, but I suddenly realized that could be like the organizing principle of the story. And it will be a story, like, you know, the introduction, which is just kind of theoretical, but the rest is a narrative. But a narrative structured around a certain theoretical model.
And I just have to ask, before we dive into the economics, which I think is a really interesting question here, what was the archival research like for a project like this?
So I think I did the most thorough archival research about the Soviet rule in the run-up to the war. You know, all sorts of stories that, you know, how I found a KGB document in Prague and I had to look over my shoulder because suddenly I get really stressed that someone would be looking for it. Maybe it's there by mistake. And also how I found the internal semi-clandestine publication of the Syrian Baath Party in the basement of the Tel Aviv University. So that's where I really invested a lot of time in doing archival research. But as I thought about Israel and the U.S., I thought there's so much published already that I don't think I need to research the archives anew. It's just a matter of rethinking and reinterpreting the story that we already know. And of course, you know, nobody spoke about Israel's economy before the war, not in depth. So that was, you know, secondary literature, but weaving it into the story was kind of new.
Okay, so we've teased this economics angle. The Six-Day War, and you've said you see these broad trends between the combatants. So what are those trends? What are you seeing that's facing simultaneously Syria, Egypt, and Israel, and Jordan as well?
Okay. So I should say that I was influenced by a very important scholar, which is myself. I wrote a few years previously an article in Third World Quarterly. And it argued basically that non-alignment movement, the whole Third World Coalescing project that was in force between 1955 and 1965, collapsed due to economic reasons. And it's basically a business cycle, a business cycle is about the ebb and flow of the economy. So back in the mid-1950s, third world countries looked like a very good investment opportunity. They were growing briskly, and people do what they usually do in times of high growth in the economic periphery. They extrapolate into the future and say, this and this state would be the powerhouse of the next century, you know, the way they talked about Argentina. At the end of the 19th century is the land of tomorrow, and it still is the land of tomorrow. I suddenly realized that the same process was taking place also in Middle Eastern countries. Back in the mid-50s, they looked like a good investment opportunity, but not just to private investors, but also to states, okay? Both Israel and Egypt and Syria got a lot of aid from the superpowers. And what the superpowers thought, you know, beside the strategic game of gaining influence, but also that they were buying access into future markets that were going to grow and grow. What people start to realize in the mid-60s, both inside developing countries and in developed countries, that their future, their industrial growth, it will be a more complicated story, and it will take more time. And for the time being, like by the mid-1960s, the project kind of fizzled. Money wasn't allocated responsibly. The factories that were created by using aid money were inefficient and were badly run. So when we get to the mid-60s, you find that, you know, the Israeli economy, the Egyptian economy, the Syrian economy, they all face a downturn. Added to that, all of them, that's something I may have not emphasized enough, all of them get the same kind of advice from the IMF. So usually you talk about the Washington consensus when you get to the 90s, but it seemed that the IMF was implementing a Washington consensus already back in the mid-1960s, and the World Bank and the IMF were saying to developing countries the same thing: you must cut the budget. And only by cutting the budget and raising taxes, you will halt the deficit in your balance of trade, and your external debt will decline. Now, how does that affect politics? Up to that point, governments in Israel and Egypt and Syria, they could play Santa Claus. They always had money to give, and they always had the tools to maintain full employment. get jobs to everybody, and especially the educated, because they're the most, you know, politically volatile. But once you get to the mid-1960s, they don't have those tools at their disposal anymore. And civilian governments become incredibly unpopular. And those are the same people, you see. Like Levi Eshkol, he's the prime minister of Israel on the eve of the Six-Day War. He was also the finance minister from the 1950s up to the 1960s. Gamal Abdel Nasser, it's the same protagonist all the time in Egypt. He's there. He's the president from 1954 to 1967. So these two leaders, they become increasingly unpopular. And that's where the story of civil-military relations gets into the picture. This is where the army steps in, the military steps in, and fills the kind of political void that was created by the collapse in the popularity of civilian leaders.
Wonderful. Let's dig a bit into the behavior of the respective combatants in this war. So what are the positions of the various Arab states? Because they are distinct. I definitely got that sense, having read the book.
We're starting to talk about the crisis itself, the crisis that leads to the war, right?
Yeah, and what's going on that's pushed? I mean, so we've got these sort of broad economic forces that really are wreaking havoc sort of on everybody.
Right.
Israel's facing it.
I think
maybe differently, but similarly.
Right. So I think we can move from the weakest link, which was the Syrian economy, and go through Egypt and then end with Israel. So in the weakest link, the Syrian economy that was, you know, less developed than the other two, the army simply took over. Okay, there used to be a strong, well-connected urban Sunni elite in Syria that ran the affairs of the state basically from 1944 up to 1964. And although Syria experienced many military coups, government came back to the hands of civilians in Damascus at the end of the day. And that wasn't the case from 1965. So basically 1965, there's a coup in which the army takes a prominent role. And then in February 1966, the army takes over. Syria becomes a full-fledged military dictatorship. And one of the main reasons that the army could have done that was that around between 62 and 64, the civilian government in Syria implemented an IMF sanctioned policy. Okay, so that eroded basically undermined an elite that used to rule Syria for, you know, more than 20 years. And once the generals take over in Syria, they will kind of export the Syrian instability to the rest of the region. One way of in which they thought to ingratiate themselves to the Syrian population was to escalate the conflict vis-a-vis Israel. So that's what's happening in Syria, and specifically Syria gives refuge to Fatah guerrilla organization, which is the main Palestinian organization fighting Israel. So the Syrians don't just host them. They help them train. They give them weapons. And I think by the time we reach 1967, they think about the Fatah as an arm of the Syrian military intelligence. So that's what's happening in Syria. We can move then to Egypt, facing a very similar crisis. You know, once upon a time, the Egyptian economy looked on a very promising path. I think Egypt got, you know, between the mid-50s to the mid-60s, Egypt got from the Soviet Union and the United States something around the sum of $2 billion, which was significant. It funded about a third of its development plans. But by the time we get to 1965, the money dries up. Both the U.S. and the Soviet Union are kind of disappointed by what they got on their investment. And, you know, Nasser, like the civilian government in Syria, he needs to implement austerity measures. And then there are the lines, you know, in the markets. You want to get flour or fish or rice. Something will be missing. Sometimes, you know, all the essentials, sometimes some of them. If it's if it occurs during Ramadan and, you know, people have to cook the iftar, the meal that breaks the fast as during nighttime. So the government will make an extra effort to make sure that everything would be in the market. But during the rest of the year, you experience shortage of foodstuffs all the time. And then there are all those fun things that you buy for your home, like refrigerators and TVs and cars. You had to line and register for that as well. You couldn't just go to a store and buy one. And as Gamal Abdel Nasser is implementing those measures, he becomes increasingly unpopular to the point that there's a new underground movement of the Muslim Brotherhood planning to assassinate him and other ministers. And the revelations from the investigation of the Muslim Brotherhood shook Nasser to the core. So he would be using the army for the next 2 years as basically an internal police force, a Praetorian guard, if you will. And that makes the army also very powerful. And one of the things that the army wants to do, and the person who heads the army, Abdul Hakim Amr, is to deploy Egyptian forces in Sinai, which is demilitarized for over a decade as a result of kind of an informal agreement between Egypt, the U.S., and Israel. So that's the Egyptian case. And then you get to Israel, which, you know, was doing much better, was affected by an economic downturn, but not to the same extent of the other two. You know, what was missing in Israeli markets? So people in Tel Aviv, the town from which I'm speaking right now, so people in Tel Aviv could go to restaurants less. They bought less red meat. They didn't shop for cakes, right, so much. I mean, their life were not that miserable, but comparing to what happened 3 or 4 years ago, they weren't doing so well, and they were they stopped buying carpets and furnitures. So they expressed their resentment also in the popular press. And Eshkol was, you know, he always looked like a very nice uncle, but he wasn't very charismatic. He had to face the fact that every time he was out in public, he got jeered and booed and was treated in general disrespectfully by the audience. So he thought I found a cure for that, and he started using the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, kind of irresponsibly. to shore up his popularity and letting them have a go at the Syrians. So the three parts of the story is connect by mid-May 1967. The Syrians were escalating their campaign against Israel by sponsoring Fatah attacks, which weren't, incidentally, weren't very lethal. They also made it seem as if the Syrians, that is, as if they're about to divert the tributaries of the Jordan River and thereby deprive Israel of running water. The scheme didn't have a chance, but there were a lot of people in Israel that they saw political gain in pretending that was a real threat. So the IDF in turn was initiating border skirmishes with the Syrians. And finally, in response to one of them, or the threat that another one will occur, Egypt deployed its forces in Sinai. And thus started a mad chain of events that ended with the Six-Day War.
Now, it's interesting, especially you bringing up the, you know, this series of provocations that everybody seems to be using for their own end, heedless of the fact that it's stoking this, you know, increasingly sort of a hot environment. What's the IDF's long-term goal, especially as it's sort of eyeing its various Arab neighbors?
Well, that's an argument I have with several Israel historians. And that is, and the argument is over what is the meaning of a contingency plan? If a military, you know, if an army as an organization has a contingency plan to attack and destroy neighboring armies and then move forward to conquer large chunks of neighboring territory, is this just, you know, something you write down for a rainy day? Or that you could use those plans as proof that this is indeed what the Israeli army was planning to do. And going back to 1953, the IDF had plans to conquer basically all the territories it conquered in June 1967. And it wasn't just, you know, plans as in, you know, sort of a philosophical debate in a seminar that just happened to be printed on paper. It was also, you know, a plan of action. So the IDF trained in a way that would allow it to implement those plans. It applied incredible pressure on the government that it would increase its budget so it can purchase all those aircrafts and tanks and armored troop carriers that were needed to create a very mobile military force that would be able to maneuver swiftly and just move very rapidly in order to conquer as much territory as possible in the shortest time. And as I said, it also purchased the weapons. It also purchased the materials that would enable the army to do that. That was the plan of Israeli generals for, you know, two successive generations of generals. You know, officers came and went, but the plans stayed the same. They sometimes updated every 5 years. They updated those plans to make sure that, you know, everything is in place. And yeah, and the last thing I should mention, like, there was a lot of effort that went into acquiring the knowledge, the intelligence that would be necessary to implement those plans. You know, it happens a lot in life that you watch someone do something very complex and hard, and he's doing it effortlessly. So you think maybe it's really easy. And the Israeli army had a very convincing victory in June 1967. It was a war that lasted just 6 days, and as a result of which, Israel tripled in territory. But the fact that it was done so swiftly and so efficiently was the result of long-term patient preparations.
What's the role of the Soviet Union here? We've alluded to these aid programs, but they're sort of lurking in the background of all of this. What are they doing?
So in terms of the history of the history or the history of the book, this is where I started. I was invited to a book launch of a book titled Fox Bets Over Dimona. And the main argument of the book was that the Soviet Union initiated the war. That by the time that the book was published in 2007, that was the long-standing argument. That for some reason, the Soviet Union wanted a war to erupt in the Middle East. And how do we know that? Because Nasser said that. He said that the main reason that he deployed his army in Sinai was that he got an intelligence report from Moscow. And the intelligence report said that Israel would attack Syria within a few days. And Syria and Egypt had a military pact that stipulated that an attack on one was essentially an attack on the other. And he, you know, had to help his ally or lose face. Now, the claim is that the intelligence report was false. I mean, Israel did not deploy forces on its northern border, and that is taken as proof that Israel had no intention of attacking Syria. And I think what you can say about the story is that if you can say that the fact that the Egyptian army was deployed in Sinai was sort of a punishment, then Israel was like this thief that gets punished on the single loaf of bread he didn't steal. So, because Israel had plans to attack Syria, it had long-standing plans specifically to take the Golan Heights. And at the specific time that the Soviet Union delivered that famous intelligence report, you didn't need a Soviet spy in Israel to know that Israel was going to attack Syria, because that's what Israeli leaders said in public. Okay, and this didn't end there, because unknown sources or knowledgeable sources in Israeli general staff leaked to military correspondents the exact plan. So it was kind of elaborate what Israel would do. So that Soviet intelligence report wasn't a lie. It missed the date, but it wasn't a lie. Moreover, I speculate in the book that the information about the impending Israeli attack was gleaned not just from newspaper, but from an agent the Soviets thought was working for them, but actually was working for Israel. And I think Israel basically wanted to convince the Syrians once and for all that it means business. And what can convince the Syrians more than leaking to the Syrians through the Soviets that Israel will attack them? So I think the Soviet intelligence got hoodwinked by the Israeli intelligence, and then things got out of control. Having said that, what is the broader perspective of the Soviet role in the region at the time. The Soviet Union sold weapons to Syria and Egypt, also because it thought it was a good business for Moscow and also for its allies. Czechoslovakia was also big on selling weapons in the Arab world. The Soviet Union was also supplying economic aid, both for Egypt and Syria. The Soviets were big on dams. They already built the Aswan Dam in Egypt, and they were about to build a dam on the Euphrates in Syria. I think both in the government, specifically the Prime Minister Alexei Kosygin, and in the foreign ministry, there were people that wanted to avoid war in the Middle East at all costs. Some kind of careful engagement with Israel, that's okay. If the Egyptians want to deploy their forces in Sinai, the Soviets might back this kind of decision. But once Egypt closed the Straits of Tiran, which was a known casus belli because, you know, Israel declared it so, then a lot of people in Moscow were hinting to the Egyptians that was wrong, that they should think of a way to back down from that step. At the same time, Moscow was not united. And at the same time that people like Kosygin and Gromyko and another minor figure that I write about, Vladimir Semyonov, they were trying to calm the water and make sure that what happened in the Middle East in May 67 would not end in a war, there were opportunistic elements, specifically in the Kremlin. Someone like Leonid Brezhnev, the party chairman, and also within the military establishment, that, you know, using Rahm Emanuel's famous phrase, "Don't let a good crisis go to waste." That maybe this was a good opportunity for Moscow to get something it always wanted to have. And that is permanent access to naval facilities, both in Syria and Egypt, because the Soviet Navy is thinking globally, and it thinks about the Mediterranean as a good spot for it to augment its naval presence, create a counterforce through the presence of the Sixth Fleet, maybe make it harder for Polaris submarines to launch missiles at the Soviet Union if a war ever occurred. And in order to do all that, you have to have, you know, permanent facilities in places like Alexandria and Latakia. So while someone like Kosygin is trying to hint to the Egyptians that, you know, you played a good game, now it's time to settle down and calm things, the Soviet general staff is saying something different, something along the line that we're in the Mediterranean with very powerful weapons, and if you ever need us, just whistle. And that emboldened the Egyptian government to continue on the same disastrous path, you know, on which it embarked on the 15th of May.
And what about the United States? I mean, they're sort of the other side of that superpower coin.
I can tell you two things. One is the Soviet rule, about which I spoke about at length just now, that was a kind of ignored in most of the reviews on the book. So maybe, I don't know, it doesn't connect to the present that much. Maybe it's like, you know, ancient the ancient story of the Cold War. But also, most of what I wrote about the American role in the crisis was ignored because it's kind of inconvenient. What I say basically is that, at least for the Middle East, the fact that John F. Kennedy was assassinated in November 1963 was a very important development. So Kennedy was big on giving aid to non-aligned countries. He tried to create a strategic alliance with Gamal Abdel Nasser. His assistants calling Gamal Abdel Nasser in one of the documents, Mr. Big of the Middle East. And that went by the... And he also was trying to keep Israel at bay, Kennedy. And that went by the waste paper basket once Lyndon Johnson replaced Kennedy in the White House. Johnson didn't like giving economic aid to developing countries, but he was a fan of arms sales. And while Kennedy gave something like $500 million of subsidized wheat to Egypt during his time in the Oval Office, Lyndon Johnson sent $800 billion worth of weapons into the Middle East up to the Six-Day War, specifically selling weapons to Israel, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Iran, that incidentally, all of them sworn enemies of Gamal Abdel Nasser. And when, you know, push comes to shove, you know, those crucial 3.5 weeks between the 15th of May until the 5th of June when Israel attacked, the White House was winking at Jerusalem more and more desperately in a hope that, you know, the Israelis would get the message without Lyndon Johnson actually saying to them, go and beat that SOB as hard as you can. And that SOB is Gamal Abdel Nasser.
That's the role of the U.S. And this is a question, you know, I'm sure you could teach an entire semester on this particular question. So, you know, don't feel the need to try to bite off more than you can chew. What do you see as the significance of the war's outcome?
Well, in the most concrete way, it's the fact that up to 67, there was a border that separated most of the Palestinians from most of the Jews that inhabited Israel / Palestine. So, you know, the great majority of the population in Israel is Jewish, and the great majority of the population that resides in the West Bank and Gaza is Palestinian. Now, at the end of the war, that border was erased, and what you got was basically a binational community that increasingly from 67 up to this day was living with a sort of a slow motion civil war that, you know, kind of intensified from 87 up to today. If we go back a little bit, then there wouldn't have been a peace agreement between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Jordan without the Six-Day War. There was always the theory before the Six-Day War that the importance of gaining territory in a war with the Arabs is that the new territories can be used as a chip in a negotiation with Arab countries, and that materialized. Israel gave back Sinai to Egypt in 1979, and that ensured that the signing of the Camp David peace accords. And later in the early 90s, Israel gave back to Jordan a not very significant amount of territory and was able to sign a peace agreement with it as well. And I think most of what I said up to now isn't debatable. What is debatable is two things. And that's also, I think, two effects of the war. One is the war significantly strengthened the power and the role of the army within Israeli society. And it will never lose that outsized role in decision making from then until today. It also affirmed to Israeli generals that the best defense is offense, right? The best way to defend yourself is to attack. And in my view, that embroiled Israel in a series of wars that were avoidable, that were in large part unnecessary. Also, when you look back at someone like Gamal Abdel Nasser, he was a secular ruler at the end of the day and used Islam as a way to legitimize his role. And this, you can say the same about the government in Damascus. If they had a religion, it was the religion of economic development, that industrialization would make everything better in the Middle East. And the power, symbolic power, ideological power of elements such as these was irrevocably broken as a result of the Six-Day War, because, they had their chance. They ruled Syria and they ruled Egypt, and they were badly defeated. And I think that strengthened various varieties of, the Muslim Brotherhood movement throughout the Middle East. This is when, people can start and say, El Islam wa al hal, Islam is the solution.
So I have a question. Is this a book that's about weak civil society in the Middle East? Because in all of these cases, you have militaries that play variously outsized roles. I mean, the military in Israel doesn't take on the size and strength that it does in Syria. And yet, in each case, the military does sort of end up playing this sort of outsized role. Do you see civil society here as a problem?
I think the problem is that it's too weak. And perhaps in Arab countries, that's a foregone conclusion, because I do think that you need to reach a certain degree of urbanization and industrialization, that you have a seizable middle class, because that's the backbone of a thriving democracy and a strong civil society. But Israel could have had a shot at having a stronger civil society. And I teach a course about Israeli foreign policy, and I always ask the students, what do you think is the difference between hawks and doves in Israeli politics? And they usually say, well, hawks are more belligerent, they're more prone to use military force, they want to maintain control over the West Bank. I said, yes, but all of those are derivatives. And the main difference, I think, between hawks and doves is that hawks believe that the conflict with the Arab world is, you can't solve it. It's eternal. It's another chapter in the long history of anti-Semitism. And it's a cultural conflict. While the doves certainly believe that at one point or another, you can solve the conflict with the Arab world. It's a conflict about concrete resources, mainly land, and then you compromise on that. And I think what the Dovs, which were usually liberal in the sense that they were supportive of, laissez-faire economy, worried about was that an internal conflict with the Arab world will create a strong state and a weak civil society. And I think at the end of the day, their fears were eventually realized, partially so because of the Six-Day War.
Would you call this book a global history? It's so ranging as it looks for the various sources of this conflict.
Well, not only that, the original title of the manuscript was Generals at the Helm, subtitled A Global History of the Six-Day War. But if you wrote a book or will write a book, or listeners will do that, they'll find out pretty quickly that they had a great idea for a title, and the press is absolutely convinced they have an even greater idea for a title. And I'm so grateful when I can find a press that will publish my book that I usually, I don't give up any fight. But initially, yes, the name I gave to the book stressed that it's supposed to be a global history of the war, and that, in difference to all the histories of the war that were basically regional.
Then I have just a couple more questions to think about here. When I teach, I always try to impress upon my students that by and large, the Middle East can be understood with the Cold War, but it's its own separate set of issues, and you can't conflate Cold War conflicts and Middle East conflicts. It's not a perfect overlap. Nevertheless, there is a Cold War issue going on here. What does the Six-Day War tell us about the Cold War?
As a result of the frozen status quo in Europe, which is basically where the Cold War started, the superpowers exported their tensions into other areas of the world. Well, that's the main thesis of Arne Westad in the Global Cold War, and that was his significant contribution to highlighting the fact that those wars by proxies that the Soviet Union and the United States engaged in Asia and Africa and Latin America and the Middle East, they took regional tensions that were existing but exacerbated them greatly. And, the Arab-Israeli conflict would have been long and protracted, but it was definitely made far more lethal because of superpower intervention and the fact that they sold weapons in their effort to outbeat each other.
All right. I have just one question left for you. What are you working on right now?
I'm hoping to have a nuclear summer. meaning that I'm working on a paper that ranges on the nuclear aspects of the Six-Day War and the war that came after the Yom Kippur War, and I'm seriously considering turning that into a more broad ranging book. About the role that the political and economic role that Israel's nuclear project or a nuclear option, in Israel we're not allowed to say the explicit term unless it's preceded by according to foreign force sources. I think basically kind of a nuclear history of Israel.
That sounds very interesting and yet sort of political to navigate too.
Right.
Well, yeah. Thank you for spending so much time with us today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you very much, Zev, for initiating that.
Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.